This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 414 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Linda B. This episode, we are so excited to chat with author, historian, Outlander history fan, Christine McKenzie. We want to welcome Christine to our show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So welcome back for the third time. Where are you at now professionally? How did you find yourself there? And how are you developing?
Well, I'm now running my own company. So I decided to step away from academia. My last contract came to an end in 2017. And unfortunately, I have a family member who's not very well. So we had a discussion about maybe sort of splitting our time between the UK and Spain. And I decided maybe just to give academia a miss in that case. So I decided to set up my own company, and this was before COVID. But then COVID happened just sort of 10 days before we'd put an offer in a place in Spain. Actually, the UK started going into lockdown. So we scrapped the plans about going to Spain for the winter months, and we were stuck in the UK for sort of 2 years. Lockdown in Scotland was very, very strict. For months on end, we couldn't go anywhere. We had to stay in our houses unless it was absolutely necessary. And it was at a time when I'd finished one project and I'd started another, but that one ground to a halt because we couldn't get into the libraries or any archives. So then I decided, well, what am I going to do? Because I can't write academic history books. There's no way I can get into libraries and archives. So then I decided to write a historical fiction novel, as you do. In fact, I know that other people had the same problem, other historians, and they've done exactly the same thing. I think Sarah Fraser has done the same thing, and she's writing a series of historical fiction novels, and the first one's going to be published this year. So we've all adapted during COVID and during lockdown, and writing historical fiction novel was one of the ways that I sort of did it, only on the basis that I couldn't get into any archives or look at any manuscripts to do academic work. So that's kind of sort of where it started. But the idea for the book came much earlier. The idea for the book actually came via, now I'm going to mention the B word, which is very controversial in Britain and Europe, Brexit. And for the Americans that don't know what Brexit is, it was when Britain voted to leave the European Union. I wanted to stay, but obviously that's not the way that the vote went. Now, to put this into a bit of context, I grew up in the oil and gas capital of Europe, Aberdeen in Scotland. And when I went to school, I went to a very multicultural international school. It was one of the oldest schools in the city. But because we have French oil companies, American oil companies, we have British oil companies all in Aberdeen, when I grew up in Aberdeen in the 90s, it was a very multicultural place. So we had Dutch schools, we had French schools, we've had American schools. There was a large American expat community in Aberdeen because of oil and gas. So I grew up in a very international, multilingual environment. I mean, it wasn't unusual for parents of some of the children at school to come in and speak in their native language, whether that be in French or whether that be Flemish. So, you know, I was very attuned to hearing different languages other than English. So I was brought up in a very international community. But out of all these connections in Aberdeen through the oil and gas industry, it was the Franco-British connection which has had the most impact on my life. My parents have worked for French oil companies. My other members of my family have worked for French oil companies, and so much so that my godparents were transferred to Paris in the mid-90s. And during the school holidays, I used to go to Paris for my holidays, which is very nice. And I obviously got to see all the tourist sites like the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, the Pompidou Centre. But our nearest major tourist attraction was the Palace of Versailles. And that's where the novel really, really sort of came from, because we used to go to the Palace of Versailles and its gardens on a regular basis because it was our nearest. Well, it was our local park, not to boast, but, you know, it was our nearest local park. So there used to be a farm at the back, and we used to take my godson, who was then about, you know, two, three years old, we used to take him to the farm at the back of Marie Antoinette's hamlet, and we used to visit the palace and its gardens on a regular basis. And I fell in love with the place. It's absolutely beautiful. If you ever do manage to make it to France, I highly, highly recommend that you pay a visit to the Palace of Versailles. I know I won't have to convince Outlander fans that much about going to Versailles, because, you know, it's probably one of the places that you all do want to go to, but it is absolutely stunning. I mean, I remember walking through the palace and I was just in awe of the beauty of the place and the amount of gold and marble and the architecture. It's just absolutely stunning. And so that's kind of where it started. And I've been interested in Louis XIV ever since. And it very much became an extension of the interests I had already in the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, and in Oliver Cromwell and the Civil Wars and 17th century history in general.
One of the things we haven't done, which understandably, because it's not necessarily the focus of our, you know, typical show or typical episode, is, you know, talked a ton about Outlander or Jacobite or Scottish related, historically Scottish or Scottish mm-hmm. history related sites out with of Scotland, right? We haven't, Summer and I haven't really done that. And most of our travels related to anything Outlander have obviously been in Scotland. But this is, it's interesting because obviously, especially episodes, season two obviously predominantly took place in France, or much of it, the first half at least, took place in France. And season three, well, was in Scotland and then in the New World. So, and since then we've been in the New World. So yes, I say Scotland, but then ever since season three, we've been in the colony. So, but we don't, other than maybe the now and again mention of, like, you know, North Carolina, or Summer sees something on the show or in the book, and Summer will talk about something she's seen because she lived on the East Coast for a bit. So she makes connections sometimes with regard to the New World and its portrayal or certain spots or places that she knows of. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. And yeah, any kinds of recommendations or that you have with regard to what might tempt an Outlander fan or what might be interesting to them when they go to France or when they go to wherever. It's a good reminder that you don't have to stay in Scotland to see Jacobite history, right? There's so much else, so many other things touched it.
I mean, Rome as well is another good example of where there's a lot of Jacobite history, because after, you know, they'd stayed in Paris, they then went to Rome. So Rome is another place where you'll find a lot of Jacobite history as well. But as I say, for me, primarily, the Franco-British relationship with regards to writing the book was immensely important, because it's had such a positive impact on my life. And it was probably, it was a very happy time in my life to go away on holiday and stay with my godparents. But also as well, I'm very passionate about the Franco-British relationship, especially its military aspect. I think it's very important to recognise that France and Britain have been military allies for, you know, for three centuries. And we do have the Entente Cordiale, which has been around for, you know, more than 100 years. And that was something that I was very conscious of when writing the book. The book is actually a celebration of the Franco-British relationship. And it was written at a time when Franco-British relations were becoming soured. I mean, thankfully, in the past week or so, they've done an about turn with Rishi Sunak and Emmanuel Macron. They get on really, really well. But under Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron, the relationship really suffered. And as the relationship was getting worse, the faster the book was actually being written. So it actually sort of propelled the sort of downturn in the relationship actually propelled the book forward and me writing it during lockdown. As I say, it is a relationship that I'm very passionate about. It means a lot to me. I spent a lot of happy times in France with my family. I had friends at school who were bilingual, who were, you know, could speak French and English. So it really saddened me when things weren't great between Britain and France during Boris Johnson's premiership. But now everything's, you know, a lot better than it was, and I'm absolutely delighted. So that's, as I say, that's really the roots of where this novel sort of came from.
Would you say that when you decided the events that in your life that were going on, or the circumstances that were going on at the time as you were around 2017, as you were leaving academia, or when you decided not to return, or you decided to take a break, or however you would phrase that, when you decided to start your own company and you had these different circumstances going on in your life, once you made that decision, did you know pretty quickly that you're going to be writing La Gale Écossaise?
Yeah, as I said, the book was already in my head. The idea of the novel was already there. It's just that lockdown gave me the opportunity to actually write it. Initially, it was going to be a weekend evening thing just for a bit of fun. And to be honest, I didn't think the book was going to go anywhere. I didn't even think I would publish it. So it was just initially a bit of fun. But maybe I should talk about where the inspiration for the main character comes from and give you a further idea of the flavor of the book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Go for it.
I was going to say, there's a lot of people in that time period. How do you choose just one?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. His name's John Hamilton, and he's fictional. He's not real, but he's the head of an elite regiment of men who protect Louis XIV. Now, it's a hidden regiment, and it's less Three Musketeers and more Special Forces. So if you enjoy the Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, you will enjoy these novels, or you will enjoy this particular novel. This is the first of seven. But it's less Three Musketeers and more Special Forces. They're a hidden elite unit. Nobody knows that they exist until Robert Meldrum is writing this book and he's sort of seeing what these men have done and what they achieve. And their job is not just to protect the king or the elites. Their job is to go in there and rescue people before they die when other people are doing some pretty awful things. So it is more like Special Forces than Three Musketeers. Everything's sort of cloak and dagger. The main character of John Hamilton was actually inspired by a real soldier. And this soldier was, now this sounds really bizarre, but he was inspired by a soldier from the Second World War. one of the founding members of the Special Air Service called Robert Blair Main. And Robert Blair Main was born in Ulster in 1915. He was 6 foot four. He was 230 pounds. He was muscular. He was athletic. He was a high achiever. He was studying law at Queen's University Belfast when the Second World War broke out. But he'd already been a rugby player for the British and Irish Lions rugby team, which you have to be selected for. It's like an international elite rugby team. And then he was also, Ulster University's boxing champion. So he had a reputation that preceded him, a bit like my character, John Hamilton, who, he was very much one of the soldiers that the Nazis were terrified of during the war. He had a reputation that preceded him. And like Blair Main, John Hamilton is 6 foot four, he's 250 pounds, got a broad back, he's extremely muscular, and he terrifies Louis XIV's enemies. So Blair Main inspired the character John Hamilton because I was reading Hamish Ross's acclaimed biography on Blair Main during the early stages of the book. And I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful if, because I knew that the book was going to go into a special forces direction anyway. It's just that Blair Main gave me a template, let's say, for my character. And that was very much the case. But in my case, I had to make Hamilton a Catholic. Blair Main was very much an Ulster Scot. He was from the Protestant community in Northern Ireland. But I had to make Hamilton a Catholic because Louis XIV never would have had a Protestant as being head of his elite forces or his security. That would have been a major problem for Louis XIV. So I had to change that. But I thought to myself while I was writing it, how interesting would it be if you had a planter that was Catholic? And there were Ulster planters that were Catholic. Okay, there were few and far between, but there were four or five families from Scotland that went in as part of the plantation under James I of Britain, who were Catholic, and the Hamilton family, who are real, were Catholics. And I just thought that would be really interesting sort of dilemma for somebody like that to be caught up in the 1641 Irish Rebellion, which is often characterised as, the Irish Catholics masquerading the Protestants. That's a very sort of simplistic view of the whole scenario, because you had, for example, Scottish settlers who were upset with the fact that the English settlers got all the best land. So the Scottish settlers ended up joining with the Irish to massacre the English. So, it's not as clear cut as people often assume. So that's kind of where I wanted to go with it. I wanted my character to come from out with Scotland, but have Scottish heritage. In fact, I was very keen to make sure that all the men in this elite unit, Le Garde Écossaise, which were six men, all came from different parts of the sort of Scottish British martial culture. So, for example, you've got John Hamilton, who is from Ulster in Ireland. He's of Scottish lineage. He's a planter, and he represents the warrior culture of the Ulster Scots. Then you have Alistair MacDonald, who's another member of this elite team, who is a Scottish Highlander through and through, and he represents the Scottish Highlander warrior culture. And then you've got Timothy Gray, who's the intelligence officer for the unit. He is descended from Border Reavers. His name is Gray, but he is born on the English side of the border. The Border Reavers straddled both England and Scotland, as the name suggests, and they had their own warrior culture. So you had English Greys, Scottish Greys. You have English Armstrongs, Scottish Armstrongs. These clans straddled the Anglo-Scottish border and had their own martial culture, and that's what Grey represents. Then you've got Peter Molyneux, for example, who is sort of representative of, I suppose, a later sort of Scottish outlook, which is he wants to travel away. He's desperate to leave Britain, and he goes travelling the world, discovering new places. Now, I had been reading on Robert Louis Stevenson, the author of Kidnapped, again, another Jacobite connection. And I was reading about his life story. I'd been invited on another podcast to talk about him. And it fascinated me that not only was he an excellent author, but he was travelling the world and he saw many different cultures, people, things. And, you know, there's this phrase that you will find Scots in every corner of the world. And we have been quite a sort of mobile group of people, if you like. You will find us everywhere. And to a certain degree, Molyneux reflects that, although he was born in England, he reflects that side of the sort of Scottish view. And then you have Alexander Murray, who I was keen to stress that there were Scots in the 17th century that went beyond Europe and did military service. So you've got Alexander Murray, who's from Perthshire. He is like a military engineer. He's a military engineer of the group. He's obsessed with explosives and gunpowder, and he creates his own maps. He's an extremely talented man. He's spent a lot of his life in the Ottoman Empire, and he has converted to Islam. Because, of course, he was a Janissary, what they call a Janissary, which was an elite member of the Ottoman forces. And to be a member of that, and many European people did this, they went into Ottoman service and they converted to Islam. So I've got Alexander Murray doing this. And he, as I say, he learns about sort of Arab ways, about military engineering. He can speak fluent Arabic. He takes a lot of the techniques and things back to France when Hamilton draws him into his elite unit. And then you've got Robert Meldrum, who is the baby of the group. He's the new guy, and he's drawn into the unit, and he represents a sort of Scottish lowlander element of, you know, Scottish martial culture. But also, I was very keen as well to emphasise the fact that although the unit's called Le Garde Écossais, it's actually reflective of the reality at the time. Louis XIV had several elite units with the name, you know, Garde Écossais attached to them. The first one was the Scottish Company, First Scottish Company, which was founded in the Middle Ages as part of the Auld Alliance. And a lot of Scotsmen initially were obviously attracted to that regiment, but as time had gone on, and by the time you get to Louis XIV's reign, the First Scottish Company was actually filled more with Frenchmen than it was with Scotsmen. And then you've got another sort of Garde Écossais unit, which was a gift from the kings of Britain to the kings of France. You have to bear in mind that Louis XIV and King Charles II reigned at the same time, but they were cousins, they were family. And King Charles II had spent time in France in exile in the 17th century. So Louis XIV and King Charles II, and indeed his brother James II, from where we get the name Jacobites from, they shared men, as in it was a tradition that the Stuarts would send over a unit of Scotsmen to the King of France as a sort of gift, if you like. And there was a unit there known as Garde Écossais. However, this is why historians get confused about the Gard Écossais, is that there's another element by which Scots were drawn across to France, which is the fact that Scottish Catholics who were thrown out of Britain because of their religion, such as the Marquess of Huntly, were forced to go to France and find employment. And we have, in the 1630s, we have evidence of the Marquess of Huntly raising a unit of gendarmes for King Louis XIII in the 1630s. So there are lots of links between, military links between France and Scotland in this period. And as it happened, and this is a strange thing that happened towards the end of me writing this book, is that I've always known that I'm a direct descendant of the Marquess of Huntly, but I did not know that the Marquess of Huntly raised a unit of gendarmes for a King Louis XIII. I also have another ancestor who served in the bodyguard of King Louis XVIII. So I find it very, very strange that I find that out towards the end of writing the book. Another thing I have to sort of mention, which I should have mentioned earlier, was that although these units were called Gard Écossais, as time went on, Englishmen were drawn into these regiments, Scotsmen obviously continued to be drawn, but also Irishmen as well were continued to be drawn to France. And what would happen is this unit got less and less Scottish as time went on. These units, and Louis XIV got fed up of having multiple Scottish guards, an English guard, an Irish guard, and at one point he just said, right, I've had enough, I'm going to create a British brigade and you're all going in there, whether you like it or not. And of course the Irish all protested. They were really upset because the Irish do not see themselves as British. But Louis XIV, being Louis XIV, was like, who cares? You know, I'm the king, you do as I say. If you're going to, you get into the British brigade. And so the Irish had no choice but to comply. They were very upset with this idea. So this idea that within the Gard Écossais, you've got two Englishmen, you've got a couple of Scotsmen, and you've got a man from Ireland, is actually very reflective of the reality of the units serving under Louis XIV at that time. So I just thought I would sort of explain that, but also it is very reflective of the British military in general. From the 17th century onwards, the British Army as we know it today began to form. And initially Scotland, England and Ireland had their separate entities, and then gradually what happens during the 17th century is they begin to merge. People, transfer to different units, and a sort of British military entity begins to emerge. And this happens, as I say, in France as well, with the foundation of the British Brigade. So it is very much sort of saying, although we've had the Entente Cordiale for 100 years, the Franco-British military relationship goes all the way back over three centuries. And of course, for those of you who clearly have watched Outlander, you will know that, via the Jacobites, there were military connections with France, because of course Louis XIV, and his successors lent the Stuarts his own men, but also sent over those regiments that were British that had been gifted to him in order to fight for the Jacobite cause. So you'll have a lot of, say, Irish Catholics who come back home to fight for the Stuarts, or Scots who have been exiled in France who come back home to fight for the Stuarts. So it's all part of my novel fits into this wider military, Franco-British military exchange that is going on. And that's really where the Gard Écossais fits. I've been used to writing academic books, and I was much more comfortable with that writing historical fiction novel is a completely different way of writing. And it was completely new. As I said before, when I started writing this novel, it was just a fun thing. It was weekends, evenings, and I wasn't sure if it would ever get published. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If it does work, then great, you know. But it is a completely different way of writing. In some ways, it's a lot more liberating because you're dealing with fictional characters, although you do have to do a lot of historical research behind that to make sure that the character fits with what's really going on at the time. And I was very conscious of that. I did something which you don't usually see in historical fiction novels, which is I added footnotes, which is more of an academic practice. But it just made me feel more comfortable adding in footnotes when I talked about sort of real situations, especially during the 30 Years' War, which is very, very complex. I just felt more comfortable putting in footnotes. So even though I'd switched to writing historical fiction novel, old academic habits tended to die hard. And I've got a bibliography at the back as well of recommended reading if people enjoy the historical fiction novel and they want to know more about the history behind the novel. But I tried to make John Hamilton and these men as plausible as I possibly could. And hopefully make it interesting, because how I like to think of the historical fiction novel is it's not just a story, it's actually an introduction to early modern history masquerading as a historical fiction novel. I tried to pack in as much as I possibly could into the book. And that's why I wrote it as a life story. And, you know, the entire book series is going to be a series of 7 life stories that, although they all eventually come and work for the same unit, we see their lives before they enter French service, we see their lives during French service, and we see their lives when they retire. So it allowed me to widen the scope beyond Louis XIV. So, for example, when we look at this first book, which deals with John Hamilton's life, we start with his early years in the plantation of Ulster, for example. And then we go through the 1641 rebellion. Then we move on to the Scottish Highlands, where he lives for a time with a Scottish Highlander called Alistair MacDonald. And he learns certain skills, which he then takes forward into the 30 Years' War in 1643. And those skills he builds on and allows him to climb the French military to become this consummate soldier who then becomes one of Louis XIV's most trusted men. And he gets promoted into the French military, and he ends up becoming a sort of hidden bodyguard for Louis XIV and Cardinal Mazarin. But it's very important to understand that John Hamilton is motivated strongly by saving other people's lives. As I say, it's more Special Forces than Three Musketeers because of what happened to him during 1641, and I won't spoil the narrative of the book, but something terrible happens to him in 1641, and he lives with that regret of being in that situation. So he's keen to save as many lives as he possibly can, whether it be protecting Turenne during the 30 Years' War, whether it be preventing a religious war in France before it happens, or whether it be saving members of his own family, families of diplomats, or just ordinary people. I mean, in the next novel, I'm hoping to build on this theme and show how he and his men intervene to save other people's lives in really terrible circumstances. But they're people from all walks of life, and regardless of nationality as well. Hamilton doesn't think of terms of nationality. Although he serves the French, he also saves the lives of Catalans, Spaniards, In the next novel, he will be going into the Netherlands, for example. So he's a man who's driven by the need to protect other people from harm. And that's what his unit do. They go in there and they protect people from harm. So from that point of view, I enjoyed writing it. But as I say, it was a very different way of writing. And it was something, writing historical fiction was something I had to grow into. It wasn't something that came naturally, but I enjoyed it at the end of the day. And I guess I achieved something in lockdown, and that's something I'm kind of pleased about, really.
It was your lockdown baby.
Yeah, it's just something that came out of lockdown. And as my mum said, my poor mother had to be the proofreader. And she said, it's an achievement, you know, regardless of how well the book goes or how many copies it sells or whatever. It's an achievement. It's something new that you've done. So she said, you should be very proud of yourself in that sense. So, it was a new set of skills. It was new, something new to learn, and it kept me busy during lockdown. So, that was it, really. But I'm still working on academic projects. I am an academic, as I say. Academic habits die hard when you put footnotes in a historical fiction novel, which is rather unusual. So I am working on academic projects, and now we're back to the new normal. I've now gone back to that. I'm currently doing research for the next historical fiction novel, but I've now gone back to my academic projects. So I haven't given up on the academic stuff at all. I'm working hard on that, but I'm now able to do both. So it's been an interesting time, that's for sure. There were some things I had to change, some sort of story ideas where I was like, yeah, that's not going to work. And I had to rethink things. There were other things that popped up that I'd never even thought of. So, for example, I knew that the Catalans had rebelled in 1640 and they'd, you know, the Catalonian revolt, but I didn't get the extent of French involvement in the Catalan revolt. I didn't realise that the French were supporting the Catalan revolt. And again, it gave me the chance to sort of tie the novel back to special forces, if you like, especially during the Second World War, as many Catalans and Basque people ended up joining the SAS in its early days during the Second World War. So then I had a situation where I could actually weave in a storyline whereby John Hamilton trains up the Catalans in covert warfare in a similar way that the SAS did in the Second World War for the Free French and for, you know, the Basques and the Catalans. So that was really interesting to be able to sort of weave that in there. And weave these threads into the story. So that was good in that sense. So in some ways there were things that I had to sort of tweak a little bit, but there were other things, as I say, that were a nice surprise. Another one was finding out that Alistair McCullough had landed in Colonsay in November 1643. Alistair McCullough was a man that I was keen to write into the novel because, again, he's one of the sort of distant ancestors of special forces. Alistair McCullough invented something we call the Highland Charge, which Outlander fans will know all about. You've seen the scene in Culloden where the Highlanders just run towards the Hanoverians. Well, Alistair McCullough is probably the most consummate Gaelic warrior that ever lived. And he's probably the best British general you've never heard of. But he was the inventor of the Highland Charge. And he lived during the Wars of the Three Kingdoms in the 1640s. And I was very keen to get him into the novel, given the sort of long connection right the way down to special forces in the modern era. And to my surprise, McCullough landed on Colonsay in November 1643. So I could actually write him into the novel, which I never sort of expected that I would be able to. I'd sort of come up with the idea that one of Alistair McCullough's relatives, who would become one of my fictional characters, you know. So I invented this cousin of Alistair McCullough, also called Alistair McCullough or Alistair MacDonald. And I was going to write that element in the book, but I never thought that the sort of trajectory of John Hamilton's life as I'd written it and Alistair McCullough would actually land together at some point. So I actually had fun writing them both together in the same chapter. You've got John Hamilton and Alistair McCullough both taking Catholic Mass at the same time before John Hamilton goes away to Glasgow and McCullough goes back into the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. So that was fun to write, and things. So no, it's so overall history didn't really get in the way. It actually provided more opportunities for me to develop the story as it went along. So that was very, very interesting how that happened. And it was a case of just crazy paving. It was, you know, I wasn't thinking, I didn't write the outline of the book completely to begin with. I sort of had an idea that I was going to go from Ulster to the Scottish Highlands to the 30 Years' War and then to France. And then I sort of added this bit in to do with Spain because of the Catalan Revolt. But I also was keen to weave in aspects of my family history. And I've already talked about how I had this Jacobite ancestor called John Hamilton, who was Jacobite governor of Carlisle. But also I have ancestors on my grandmother's side who were caught up in the 1641 rebellion, like Hamilton. So my family history inspired the novels as well. So my ancestor back in 1641, and this is actually written in what they call the 1641 depositions, which are held in Trinity College, Dublin, that his name was Richard Running and he had young children, and his neighbour, Patrick Modder O'Donnelly, suggested that maybe they should take him and his children to safety to make sure that they didn't get caught up in the rebellion. And it was my ancestor and his next door neighbour. And my ancestor, Richard Running, turned around and said, well, sorry, Patrick, it is okay, I'll leave it because I have, you know, five young children and I'm worried that they're going to wander astray. So I won't go. I'm quite happy staying here. But my ancestor's next door neighbour went with Patrick O'Donnelly and he ended up dead. So if my ancestor, Richard Running, had ended up going with Patrick O'Donnelly, I wouldn't be talking to you right now because I wouldn't exist. So again, this is sort of family history came into writing the novel. As I say, John Hamilton loses his first wife during the 1641 rebellion, and he leaves Ulster completely. Another area where my family history came into it was when we go to Spain, and Hamilton is fed up with Mazarin. He knows that Cardinal Mazarin of France could be quite a shady character. In the novel, he pulls Hamilton away from Strasbourg. Hamilton's finished with the 30 Years' War. He ends up in Strasbourg, and he receives this letter from Cardinal Mazarin saying, you know, can you come and see me in Paris? And at first, Hamilton's like, what is this? He's thinking that maybe this letter's for Turenne and it's gone to the wrong person, but he follows these orders anyway because he's a consummate soldier, and he ends up in Paris 10 days later meeting Cardinal Mazarin. And that's when Cardinal Mazarin sends him in to Spain. So Hamilton works with the Catalans. He then ends up in Madrid. Something happens in Madrid, and he then has to flee Madrid and away from the Spanish authorities, and he ends up in Malaga. And he ends up working in a bodega or bodega, I don't know how you pronounce it properly, apologies to anybody Spanish listening, for this. But my Gordon ancestors on my grandfather's side, which is where the Jacobite line comes from, they were former Jacobites. They were present at the Battle of Culloden. Then after the Battle of Culloden failed, they fled to Spain, where they got involved in the sherry trade. And one of my direct ancestors, John Gordon of Lettich, got involved in exporting wine from Gibraltar. But there's a wider network there of Jacobites all over Spain who were involved in the wine trade. In fact, there were prominent Jacobite families in a place called Jerez de la Frontera, which is regarded as the home of sherry in the world. And that's where sherry gets its name, from Jerez. And leading Jacobite families, including the Gordons, became involved in the sherry trade. And one of the major sherry producers in Jerez de la Frontera can actually trace its roots back to Jacobites who fled Culloden. So this idea that John Hamilton then goes and works in Bodija is, again, something that I drew from my family history. And it also gives a bit of a break of the military narrative, because in here he gets a family, he marries again, he has a second wife, he has two children, and it provides a break in that sense. But again, as I say, that particular part of the novel is inspired by the Jacobite links to Spain, and particularly the sort of wine trade between Britain and Spain. In fact, the poor man that founded the Bodija, which is now one of the major sherry producers in Spain, when he came back to his home in Aberdeenshire, he ended up being chased by the Hanoverian government for taxes unpaid. He'd made a huge fortune in Spain. And then when he came back, obviously the Hanoverian regime had noticed how well he'd done and said, well, you've got to pay us taxes now. So unfortunately, when he came back to be buried in Britain, he got hit with a rather huge tax bill from the Hanoverian government. So even though he'd been away from Britain since Culloden for about 60 years, when he came back, they still hit him hard. You know, I guess it emphasises that, you know, even though you emigrate, the fact that you were a former Jacobite, it sticks with you. It's a label that stays with you. And when you return to Britain, it is not a positive label. You still get punished for what you did 60 years ago, in that sense. So that was very, very interesting. And I sort of weaved elements of that into John Hamilton's narrative, that even though he's in Spain and he comes back, he doesn't really lose his military acumen. It's still there. He's still the same person, as we find out. And he hasn't lost any of his loyalties to France or his, as I say, his military acumen. So parts of that reflect my sort of Jacobite history, if you like, that even though my ancestors worked in Gibraltar, they never really lost their Jacobite roots in that sense. And unfortunately, the British government always had one eye on them, you know, just to make sure they were behaving in that sense. So it never left you at all.
You say that you're hoping before lockdown, before COVID, to use kind of, you know, nights and weekends. You had a plan to develop and write the novel.
Yeah.
When did you think or come to the decision or have the idea that it would be part of a series? Or did you know that also from the get-go?
No, that was something that developed as it went on. Initially, John Hamilton's life was the only one that was going to be written. And initially, it was going to be one book. And then I ended up writing a 500-page book in lockdown, and I went, this is going to be too big. So I've actually had to split John Hamilton's book into two. So the first book that's been released is part one. I'm developing part two at the moment. So it kind of grew during lockdown. So initially I was just going to write one book and then that was it. But then in lockdown, the ideas developed, and this whole idea of covering the entire early modern period with these six characters started to develop, and using the historical fiction novel as a teaching tool. Because what Outlander taught me was that a lot of people love the novels, but then they became interested in the history behind the novels, and they fell in love with the Jacobites themselves and the whole history behind the novels. They became interested in the Fraser's of Lovat, for example. They became interested in what happened to the Jacobites when they got to America. Maybe became interested in what happened in France, for example, or what Bonnie Prince Charlie was really like. And in that respect, I think, you know, Outlander TV series absolutely nailed Charles Edward Stuart to a T, despite the fact that my ancestors were Jacobites and were extremely loyal to him. I can't stand Bonnie Prince Charlie at all. You know, I get quite angry with him, and this sort of portrayal of him being quite sort of having this divine sort of inspired ambition and being quite flighty and his plans being made on the hoof, and he's a bit airy-fairy, but he's got this major charm offensive where he can charm people into situations they would not ordinarily go into. And that's what happened to my ancestor, John Hamilton, who was governor of Carlisle. And he ended up paying the ultimate price. He ended up being hung, drawn and quartered on Kennington Common in London in 1746. And that makes me extremely angry. So I'm not a fan of Bonnie Prince Charlie at all. But the fact that Outlander showed me the interest that historical fiction can do in terms of making people interested in history. And that was something that I wanted to do with these novels. These novels are a historical fiction novel that you can enjoy and take it as a story and enjoy it and put it down. But also, it's also there to inspire interest in early modern history, because I feel that the 17th century is a very neglected part in terms of public awareness of British and Irish history. For example, I was at the hairdresser's a few days ago, and I was talking about my projects that I was working on for my company, and I mentioned the Great Fire of London in 1666. And also Guy Fawkes and the Gunpowder Plot in 1605. And they'd never heard of any of this. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a shame. I mean, okay, I'm really interested in it. I've been interested in Stuart history since I was 10 years old. But I thought, well, that's really a shame, because I think, you know, it is a fascinating and interesting period of history. And I just hope that these books do justice in bringing that period of history alive, and that people do become interested in it. And as I say, I've seen the interest in Culloden and in the Jacobites via Outlander. And I mean, I'm not expecting this novel to do anything like Outlander. There's no way it's going to sell as many copies as that, and I'm not expecting it to. But all I really would wish for is that anybody who does pick up these novels, does become interested in Stuart history or history during the 17th century, because I find it absolutely fascinating period of history.
I agree with you that anyone who has found interest or been entertained by the novels, the Outlander books, should absolutely pick up a copy, because they already have the stories, right? Your novel already has the tie-in to early Jacobite history and kind of setting the stage for, again, if you look at one of your early pages, I'm not sure what the technical term is. It's not the title page, but it's slightly a few pages after that. Actually, it's before the title page. It before the TOC, before the table of contents. It has the rundown of the, was it seven books? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
Sorry. Your name was a book. I counted your name. The outline of the titles of the books that you're planning on writing in this series. So yeah. I would agree with you. I think anyone who enjoys Outlander and thus enjoys the intrigue, the mystery, the excitement, the danger, and this is all real life, because all like these events and these circumstances are historical, right? They're factual. Yeah. They happened, and you don't, and that's, to me, that's the best part, is you don't have to make these things up. You just have to bring them forth and represent them to the reader. Summer and I both loved the use of the main protagonist as your storyteller, to be the person to hook us in and introduce us to the team.
There's also, I mean, I agree with what you say. I really wanted to make John Hamilton's men is as plausible as possible. So, as you say, I took real events, fascinating real events, and I put the men in those events, and that was something I was very, very keen to do. So it was a case of taking real events and molding their actions and their movements around those events rather than the other way around, if that makes any sense. And Robert Meldrum is an interesting character. For those of you familiar with the Three Musketeers, I guess you would draw a parallel with D'Artagnan. He's the young, I mean, when he's writing this book, he's a lot older. He's 65, and he's looking back over his time with Lagarde, who says, and he's recounting time with these men. But when we meet him back then in 1672, he's a young man. He's about 22 years of age, and he's being drawn into this secret world that very few people see. And he's trying to understand what's going on. And he's trying to find his feet and trying to understand what's really happening. And what I wanted to convey was the fact that to bring the reader along on that journey with him, to think, what is going on here? Who is John Hamilton? What does he do? What do his men do? And sort of bring that air of mystery along, sort of discover Lagarde, Eco says, with Meldrum as he writes it in that sense. Because that's what happens. You get drawn into the secret world, and because it's secret and hidden from view, he's learning what's really going on. And people are not really telling him what's going on. He's sort of learning his way. He's learning new skills. He makes mistakes. He falls in love, which is great, but it becomes an inconvenience because Hamilton's like, he doesn't need any distractions right now. But he's left wondering why he's been taken from Britain into France. And we only get to see why that is until the end, in that the elite units tend to, and I guess this is reflective of, you know, elite units today, you have the older generation that train the younger generation, and then the older generation move on and the younger generation take over. So it's that process whereby, you know, he's been drawn in and taught certain skills, and we follow him in this air of mystery. But it's also him trying to discover who John Hamilton really is, because John Hamilton is a very quiet person. I think I make the idea that he's very difficult to read. He says very little. He rarely shouts. And he's very, I don't know if introvert is quite the right word, but he keeps a lot to himself and he doesn't open up. as much as Meldrum would like. I think I make that point that Meldrum says he's a great leader of men, he's fantastic, but he could communicate a little bit better. And the way that Meldrum has to sort of try and read him is to read John Hamilton's facial expressions. That initially is the only clue that he kind of gets. So Meldrum, as we follow Meldrum along in the story, he's trying to fit in with these men, and he's discovering what each of them are like. And each of them have a very distinct personality. So, for example, I was very keen to write a Scottish Highlander into the novel. And this Scottish Highlander, Alistair MacDonald, is very naughty. I thought that this might appeal to Outlander fans because he's the only character in my book that swears. So, by the way, don't lend this book to your children. And, you know, one of the characters does swear. In fact, I had to tone down the swearing. I was asked by my mother to tone down the swearing in the book because it got a bit too much. But that's part of that character. He swears a lot and he's quite rough. And, you know, Hamilton's more refined, but so is Meldrum. He's this young man. He was a Protestant minister before he lands in France. He's confronted with this angry, Scottish, devoutly Catholic Highlander who absolutely loathes Protestants. And so there's this clash that goes on. And, you know, Meldrum finds, you know, MacDonald really quite difficult to work with, finds him a bit off and a bit direct, which is very much the Highlander way. Highlanders will tell you, say if you got dressed in a silly example, but it's true. Say if you were wearing something like a black dress and you asked a Highlander, does my bum look big in this? They'd probably turn around and say, yeah, it does. You know, Highlanders can be quite direct. It's just how they are. And so we've got this directness with Alistair MacDonald where he just tells it how it is, regardless of how people around him feel. And so there's this sort of clash of characters, you know, as well in terms of sort of what they're like. You've got Peter Molyneux, for example, who's this consummate gentleman. He's very posh. He wears fine clothes. He's got manners. He's very refined. And then he clashes with Alistair MacDonald as well because they're like chalk and cheese. So I was very keen to write different elements of the characters that would provide tension between them. And so, as I say, Meldrum's navigating all these different personalities, which you would do. I mean, it's a bit like starting a new job in the office. You get to know all the different personalities at work and you get to know what they're like. And you navigate, you know, that sort of situation. So Meldrum's in that situation, but as the novels go on, we will see him grow, and we will see him grow into being, I guess, Hamilton's replacement, which I've already hinted at in the book as it is. But yeah, he's a bit young, he's a bit naive, he's a bit, you know, he makes mistakes. But Hamilton's very patient with him and very, very kind, and all of them are in that sense. So, yeah, I wanted to sort of make Hamilton mysterious, but also Meldrum's journey. I wanted to carry the reader along with me on that as he discovers all the different people and characters in the book.
Well, that is great. And we can't wait to see or read adventures the group will find, or what adventures will find the men, the group, in part two of, or yeah, part two of the, of the life of John Hamilton.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Yeah. It's our pleasure to have you, to have had you back. Your series is just kicking off.
Yeah.
It's just getting started. So people have a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, it's just the first book just now, but I have, you know, six other planned. But that's where it's going to end. It's not going to go on and on and on. So Meldrum is going to be the last one. It's going to be the last one in that sense. And I just hope to cover a whole swathe of, as I say, an introduction to the early modern period. And as you say, it lays the foundations of the Jacobite rebellions that come later. As I say, it begins in 1715, as Robert Meldrum looks back. But he does mention the Jacobite rebellions and its impact on the Franco-British relationship. And I don't think he's too keen on the Jacobites in that sense, which reflects, I guess, what was going on in France at the time. The French did support the Jacobites, but the support kind of, well, it kind of waned. There is a question in Jacobite studies whether the French genuinely supported the Jacobite cause or whether they were using the Jacobites to have a go at Britain. Does that make any sense? So whether the Jacobites were being used as an instrument against Hanoverian Britain.
So whether it was a true support, a supportive relationship, or whether it was just, the Scots could absolutely and truthfully describe it as supportive, because that's you could absolutely look at it that way because that was an effect. But the main the driving impetus for the relationship you're suggesting may have been the case, which is that France wanted to stick it in some way, whenever as any way they could to the Brits or the English.
British, yeah. So there's that tension as well in the novels. There is that undercurrent of what's going on, and that's how the novels opened up. We're not, I mean, Meldrum declares he's either Whig or he's neither Whig nor Jacobite. Whether you believe him or not, I'll leave it up to the reader. But he's kind of upset about the fact that Britain and France have fallen out with each other, and that this rebellion or this Jacobite thing has taken place. So that's how the novel opens up. And as you say, it provides a foundational sort of introduction to the roots of the Jacobites and, 1745 to 46, because, as you say, it lays the foundations. We see British soldiers in the 30 Years' War fighting for France, which actually happened. We had many British people and Irish people that went across and fought for France in that sense. So in that sense, I agree with you. I think, if any Outlander fans are interested in broadening their perspective on the period, I think they would enjoy my novel in the sense that they would get a wider perspective on the Franco-British relationship and on the events which led to the Jacobite rebellions. And we'll see it in a much wider context.
Well, excellent. Again, it's been such a pleasure for us to have you back with us, and we are we can't wait for the rest of the series.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the podcast again.
Are there any projects or anything that you can or want to share that you are working on or coming up?
Well, what I would like to say is that the novel series will have its own dedicated website, which will be launched. It will be launched by the time this podcast goes out. I was going to say next week, but this is when we're recording this podcast. This is not when it's going to be out. So by the time this podcast is out, the website will be launched for the novels. And the website is www.legardecossaise.net. And on there, you will find a blog which has transcripts of podcasts. I'm doing my own novel podcast. So I have my own official podcast for the novels, which is going to be launched at the end of this month. So the transcripts of those podcasts will be on the Legard Écossaise website on the blog. And also there will be further resources. So if you are interested in the history behind the novels, there are going to be social media links to good web pages and other digital resources on specific events that the novels cover. And it really, as I say, it really is tailored towards people who are studying early modern history at college or university. That part of the project is tailored for that reason. And of course, the podcasts, the official podcast for the Lagarde Écossaise novels, will be on that website as well. But they will be uploaded to Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the usual suspects in the near future. So that's right now, that's where the project is heading. So if you are interested in these novels and you want to keep up to date with what's going on, you can either follow me on Twitter at KirsteenMM or follow me on Facebook. I've got a page, Dr. Kirsteen McKenzie, historian, or you'll find me on Instagram at earlymodernkmm. But I also have a Lagarde Écossaise group on Twitter as well as on Facebook. So if you want to keep up with what's specifically going on in the novels, go and find me basically, and come and find the novels. The podcast as well will also be on YouTube. And in that regard, there'll be sort of interesting and helpful visuals. So there'll be like video casts with sort of portraits of people of the time, images of documents, etc. So it's kind of like a podcast, but it'd be like a mini documentary as well, covering the events of the period. So yeah, come and find me on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you can join the Facebook group for Lagarde Écossaise or the Twitter group for Lagarde Écossaise to keep up with all the latest updates about the novels and supporting materials.
Excellent. So, dear listener, you have all the ways of finding and getting in touch with Kirsteen. And yeah, we thank you so much again for being here, and we cannot wait to hear more about the rest of the series.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, a special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Linda B. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon. And if you haven't subscribed to our newsletter, the Outlander Pod Gazette, please do. Find us at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at OutlanderPod.